following broadcast.
Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah.
No mai, haere mai, kia ora, and welcome to Books and Beyond. This is your host, Alison, and today I'm delighted to announce that Karen is back from an intrepid journey through Europe and beyond. Kia ora, Karen.
Kia ora, Alison. Feels good to be saying kia ora again.
Yeah, oh yay, it's so good to have you back. So we were thinking today that we would talk about Paris, because it's a city with such a rich literary history.
And also because I was just there.
Yes, and you're just back too. So, and I was there a long time ago. But we both share a love of the literary pilgrimage. And
what better city than Paris?
Yeah, that's right. Because of the famous literary graveyards, which sounds a bit macabre, doesn't it? But they're so interesting. So we thought we might make a start and talk about some of the famous
We mean the rich literary possibilities of the rich graveyards, because of course the graveyards also have famous film actors and politicians
and, as well.
I mean, wandering through graveyards is always a favorite thing. But I must say I missed one of the two graveyards in Paris. I wanted to go to both, but I did get to Père Lachaise.
Oh yes,
which is just fabulous. And that's the one I actually couldn't wait to tell you about this, even before I knew we were going to do a show dedicated to Paris, because we had talked about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas under our Literary Power Couple show, and I got to see Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas's grave.
Wow.
At Père Lachaise. Mm. I didn't think I was going to make it. It was really late. And all of a sudden, there it was. You know, fate led me there. But first of all, I have to give you an exciting piece of information. Did you ever know what the B stood for in Alice B. Toklas?
Was it Babette?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, no.
I can't believe it. I was going to surprise you with that. Who would have thought Alice B. Toklas had Babette as a middle name?
Babette's Feast. Now, how did I know that?
How did you know that?
Oh, all right. And that was going to be a surprise. So, isn't it?
That was going to start us off with a moment of... It was a tick for me, but instead it turned out to be a tick for you. But that is not actually on her gravestone.
Does it just say Alice?
Alice B. Toklas, just like she was known as Alice B. Toklas, which is good for Alice. And I actually found out that Alice, I didn't realize how much of a hand she had had in designing the tombstone. So there was, well, first of all, I learned that she was instrumental in getting Gertrude buried at Père Lachaise among the great French people that she wanted. She knew that that was where Gertrude should be laid, among the great. And if you know anything about the Alice B. Toklas Gertrude Stein relationship, you know that she was the muse, the friend, the companion, the cook,
the wife.
Admirer, the wife. Mm. Chatted with the wives when the authors would come over, as Hemingway talks about, you know, she talked to the wives. Well, she told them, I talked to the wives. Anyway, she was so humble in this role that she designed the tombstone in such a way that when you arrive at the grave from the front, you see Gertrude Stein and her dates, dates of birth and so on. And then on the back, you have to walk around the grave to the back, and on the back of the gravestone, it says Alice B. Toklas.
Yeah, I find that really sad.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's poignant. Although, it's also kind of a quirky thing. It's kind of typical Alice in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think maybe we find it sad because of a more modern approach to couples as equals.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in those days it was a lot more accepted that there was the muse and there was the great person, whereas we think of Alice as a great person on her own right.
Mm. So am I looking at that through a lens of 21st century, perhaps?
Possibly.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that was really great. And then the other, it was really nice also to see, I always love seeing what fans leave on the grave. Mm-hmm. So Gertrude had a little flower pot that was filled with pens and pencils that people had brought, and a book, which I couldn't quite tell what book it was, and possibly one of hers, possibly one written by one of her fans. And then a little heart. So this is the big thing, putting stones on the graves now. And she had a little heart made of dark stones, which is is, you know, a little bit better perhaps in terms of the upkeep of the cemetery than the graves that have that problem, the graffiti problem. Oh, so nobody yes. seemed to want to graffiti Alice and Gertrude's grave.
I'm glad about that.
But I did see, and I'm mentioning this because of this horrible heartbreak of going back to Oscar Wilde's grave and discovering that they have built a glass wall around it because there was a graffiti tradition with Oscar Wilde's grave. Did you see it when you were there?
Yes.
And, you know, the kisses. People would leave lipstick kisses all over the gravestone, all over the grave. And apparently, sadly, so I was really upset. They built a big glass thing around. You can barely see it. Turns out that there was a scientific reason because upon cleaning the grave of these lipstick marks, the stone was eroding. It's probably limestone, marble type stuff. So this was put forth as a way to preserve the sculpture. But the question is, would it not have looked better with the lipstick on it? Would you not have appreciated the sculpture better as it was with the lipstick than rather than a glass wall around it, which is now covered with lipstick?
So which is kind of gross, too, isn't it?
It is kind of gross. You're right. Yes. All the lipstick on the glass is really gross. And it impeded my vision of the testicles of the statue. Why did Karen want to see the testicles?
I was going to ask you that. But you don't have to answer.
I'm going to tell you. So the testicles, I learned, were at the center of a long, another controversy. We were speaking about controversies about graffiti. So there was a controversy about the actual statue. So Oscar Wilde, another literary pilgrimage you can make in Paris is you can actually go to the hotel where he died.
Oh.
A sad and broken man after doing his 2 years of hard labor in England for sodomy and gross indecency, I believe it was. And that was the famous hotel where he looked at the wallpaper. He was already on his deathbed and said, either the wallpaper has to go or I do. Anyway, and he ended up dying there, again, poor, buried in a pauper's grave. But his friend, Robbie Ross, who was also his literary executor, got together money from contributions, and he had him transferred to Père Lachaise, and he had Jacob Epstein, the sculptor, in the 20s, did a beautiful statue, a kind of Art Deco, sort of Assyrian-like, like sort of a flying sphinx. And apparently there was a big problem here because the testicles of the sphinx were too big, and the French plastered them over, and then Jacob Epstein fought that, and then he went back, and he was working on them at night, and in the meantime, Robbie Ross decided the way to solve this problem was to cover them with a bronze butterfly, because it had to have been in the 30s, you know, you can't think nowadays we'd put a bronze butterfly, but at the time, and then the bronze butterfly got stolen off the grave, possibly by Aleister Crowley, and then the testicles continued to offend and were eventually vandalized and carried away completely, leaving the statue testicle-less. And the testicles have never been found. There was a rumor that the cemetery manager was using them as paperweights. So apparently, in about 20 years ago, a silver prosthesis was put onto the grave to replace the stolen testicles, but I couldn't see them through all the lipstick.
But I think Oscar Wilde would probably be quite amused by all of that carry-on.
I think he would have quite liked it, just like I think probably Jim Morrison quite likes all the graffiti that says Lizard King.
Yes, on his grave. Now, I remember seeing that when that grave when I was in Paris, but I do remember all the beer bottles that were left around there. And I was trying to think today whether I left a beer bottle as well. Can't remember.
What kind of beer would that have been?
Yeah.
I guess that's the question. Would it have been silver, gold, bronze?
Yes, that's right. I just hope it wasn't something like Foster's.
I know she's being a bit cagey here. You're not telling us what it's not, but you're not telling us what it is.
What it was, I can't remember.
Yeah, I remember asking somebody saying, oh, because they have little maps they give you of the cemetery, but Jim Morrison, I figured, wasn't going to be on it. I think it was he hadn't died that long ago, and I was saying to people, will I be able to find Jim Morrison's grave? And they all said, you just keep walking until you start seeing beer bottles and Lizard King written everywhere, because it's even in the lead up to finding the grave.
Yeah, and because now it's got a metal barricade around it, hasn't it? I think, has it got padlocks or something?
I'm sure it does. I didn't go see it this time.
Oh.
But I'm sure that is absolutely full of padlocks because you cannot put a metal barrier anywhere in Europe. Love locks.
Love locks.
And I'm glad. I think Jim Morrison might have been happy with the beer bottles and the Lizard King. I don't think he would have been happy with love locks.
Yes.
So,
absolutely.
Just as well.
Yes. Well, as we were saying, things have changed a lot in Paris over the years. And because neither you and I have been or had been there for many years. And
In a true Parisian way, we'll just say many years.
They have
those great terms for age.
Yes, a certain number of years.
A certain age, and then after a certain age comes the no age. They have you get to a certain period of your later life,
and then you're
called a woman with no age.
Ageless, yes, and timeless. So you were saying that you'd noticed a lot of change, particularly around the left bank.
Yeah, well, I have to say, in some ways, I saw less change than other European cities in the sense that the French have that civic sense where, for instance, there was no graffiti. If you go to Berlin and you just see the first two floors of every building anywhere in Berlin, it's just covered with layers of graffiti. A new way of living a city, I have to say. I try to keep an open mind in that sense, although I don't think I would have been happy to see it at Paris. Paris doesn't have graffiti. This is really interesting, but what it does have, what it has succumbed to, is the shopping craze. Mm. And so that thing that I call airplane, what's it called? Airport, I call it, what's it called? Airport lobby, you know, no, it's not lobby. You know how you go to the airport and you have to walk through all the Zaras and H&Ms and Gucci's and it's always the same.
And they always look the same, no matter where you are.
Exactly. So what's that called? Airport lounge or something. Whatever it's called. And so we're walking down Boulevard Saint-Germain and all of a sudden it's like, oh, there's the Gap, or there's Zara, or there's, and it was a little bit, I have to say, I hope this doesn't sound literarily snobby, but you think about the, you know, what is the left bank famous for? It's the existentialist sitting in the cafes talking about being a nothingness. And now the cafes are like full of tourists and big bears, big teddy bears. This is a big new thing, which I don't know where that came from. Do you know about this?
No.
For some reason, like big teddy bears were being sat in every outdoor location. And then shopping, those same stores, not that it was shopping, but it was always the same stores that you see in any capital in the world.
Yeah, and I must confess, I was looking at a Google map yesterday of the left bank just to get my bearings again, but it was full of McDonald's and Starbucks and all that sort of thing, which I don't remember at all. I remember the tiny little bespoke cafes where you'd have...
I mean, this is the thing, you know, like cities have to change. So we went into a tiny little cafe, but it turned out, you know, it was, I'm not going to say the waiters were wearing little country uniforms, but almost. It was like, you know, little bronze pans are hanging in the back. So it's actually just another surface level attempt to connect with you on something that makes, that, you know, stirs your blood. And I guess, you know, in today's world, neoliberalist world, consumerism is the big thing. So
that's right.
But sometimes those old shops. So I was going to bring up this wonderful book that I read years ago. So this book is from, I think, 2010. And it's called The Piano Shop on the Left Bank. Do you know about this book?
Oh, yes, I heard of it.
Yeah. So Thaddeus Carhart, the author, had grown up in France spent part of his childhood in France. His father was a military. He's American. His father was a military attaché at Fontainebleau, of all places. And he went back to live in Paris as an adult. So, of course, he spoke French perfectly, inserted himself more into the fabric of Paris. Mm. And he's living on the Left Bank, and he decides he wants to buy a piano. And he sees there's a little shop where there's a piano, there's a little atelier where they repair pianos. So he goes in to ask if they can sell him a piano, and he meets this great character who's the star of the book. His name is Luc, who first then and there won't serve him at all until he's been introduced by someone they both know. And then after that, he has to learn about pianos. He has to try them all. He has to live with each one of them, come back every month and visit them before he can pick the one that's actually going to be his piano, so that it won't just be another piece of furniture in his house. This is Luke's big thing. And it was really, really great. And it's got a whole history of the pianos, how they started from, you know, the harpsichord on. And he's now written another book, which I've had a look at. I'm going to read. Haven't read it yet, which is called Finding Fontainebleau, which is he goes back to live, to visit Fontainebleau, where he lived just outside of Paris. So it's just, you know, half an hour from Paris. And that, I've been skimming it, so I will say it had a really great part. When you say what's changing in Paris, so one of the big changes I noticed from when I was in Paris as a child with my parents, when I went back, was they didn't have those urinals, or urinals, as Patti Smith would call them.
Yes. Oh,
as you told me, you call them too, when we talked about Patti Smith. So Paris was famous for having these pissotières on every corner, this kind of metal, round metal thing where men would go in and pee into a little falling water in the middle of core. And it made the whole city smell like urine. Basically, you would, I remember as a kid just walking around going, I just smell pee everywhere.
Oh.
And so he explained the origin of that. There's one left now in Paris. They've all been taken out. But they've left one just to show what it was once like. And the origin of this was, it was really interesting. It was tied to the French Revolution and egalitarianism. So no longer could only the aristocrats relieve themselves whenever they wanted. Even the common man would have at his disposition every, you know, every block.
Yeah.
A place where he could step in and relieve himself. So that put it in a whole new life.
So that's a real egalitarianism.
Yeah. In true French tradition. So you walk around Paris. Another thing I'd forgotten is how on every French school, written in huge carved letters, is Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité. It's written above the doors of every school. Yep. As you walk in, that's your credo.
Yes. Which, there's a lot to be said for that, too, isn't there? Yeah. A book that I have really loved, and it kind of is along the same vein of this, is the Little Paris Bookshop by Nina George. And it's been an absolute bestseller. I think it was on our
It was a top 100, yeah, yes. Yeah.
So very good. But it's about a heartbroken bookseller called Jean Perdu, which I think is quite appropriate, isn't it? Because he's quite a lost soul, really. But he has a little bookshop that's actually on a boat, but most of the time he's moored onto the side of he's tied up on the left bank. But when his heart needs him to travel, he unties the boat and goes sailing for a while. But he
goes drifting in a
drifting,
way.
Yes,
think
drifting,
about it. It's very,
I guess.
Very appropriate. The barge sort of drifts
down.
Just
drifts, yes, as his heart does as well. And Jean is a literary apothecary, which I think sounds like a fabulous thing to do. So he prescribes books for people that come onto the barge and tell him about their heart and what their heart needs.
Oh, I love that. I love the way you said they tell him about their heart rather than saying they tell him about their problems.
Their problem, yes.
It's a really beautiful way of looking at it. They tell him about their heart, what's in their heart.
Yeah. But it's a little bit similar to the piano shop on the left bank, because often he won't sell books to people because they might come in and ask for some sort of bestseller or something, and he'll say no.
Or something that looks good on their bookshelf.
Yes, yes, something that they're not going to read. One of those sort of ones that we've spoken about in the past, the books that people think they should display, and he just won't sell them. Or else he drops them into the river just to destroy, or, you know, and then dries them out so that the people won't want them. So it is, it's just a wonderful book. I really loved it. It's very poignant, and it's about his journey as well. And his wife has, he thinks, left him 20 years ago, and he's really on a search to find out what happened to his wife. But I've got the book with me here, and what I love
His wife left him.
Yes, well,
she's disappeared.
She's disappeared, and he thinks that she walked out on him 20 years ago. And
so that's another theme running through.
Yeah, and so the barge, the bookshop, goes on a journey to try and retrace the wife's journey from 20 years ago. It's actually, and yeah, and there's some twists in the river of the story.
Some
and
bends in the river.
Bends, yeah. And it's very poignant, and it's a bittersweet but charming novel. But at the back of the book, I'm holding it here with me, there's a section right at the end, and it's called Jean Perdue's Emergency Literary Pharmacy. And it's basically a book list that he calls fast-acting medicines for minds and hearts affected by minor or moderate emotional turmoil, to be taken in easily digestible doses between 5 and 50 pages, unless otherwise indicated, and if possible, with warm feet and or a cat on your lap. And it's this lovely book list of things like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Kafka, Hess, Forster. You know, it's really quite, it's an absolutely charming.
Does he have Hemingway in it?
Oh, I'll just have a look. It is in order. No, he doesn't actually. Hmm. Oh, Game of Thrones. Oh no, I'm going to put it out.
Oh, come on, we haven't read the Game of Thrones. We were just thinking of the TV show.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that was I really loved that one, actually, so highly recommended. Another book that really appeals to me is about walking around cities, because that's something I love to do as well. And that's the Edmund White that we've both been reading, or you read it a long time ago, didn't you? The Flaneur, A Stroll Through the Paradoxes of Paris.
Considering that your profile on the radio on Planet FM page for our program says a self-described flaneur.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, no, sorry, self-described free radical.
And a flaneur. Yeah.
I'm a huge Edmund White fan, as we know from past shows. Yes. But yeah, that's a great book.
I love it. And I love his descriptions of what he sees as he's walking around.
Because he lived in Paris for, I'm trying to think, somewhere between 10 and 20 years.
Yeah,
it was a long time, yeah.
Yes, through the
AIDS epidemic.
Yeah,
and he had a boyfriend who died of AIDS. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I love so much
French
what
boyfriend,
he,
I should have said, yeah.
What he describes. One of the quotes, I actually wrote it down, he says, Paris intimidates its visitors when it doesn't infuriate them, which I thought was rather good. It intimidates its visitors when it doesn't infuriate them.
Maybe I'm just hard to intimidate. Yes. I remember being intimidated. I guess possibly the size of its reputation. But I find it a welcoming city. I find it a city that embraces you pretty much. I didn't find it a standoffish city. I always find it a city where you feel like you're, and it's a treat, and they know it's a treat. I guess, yeah, the Parisians know their city is a treat. They don't really care about you. They're living their own treat.
There's
room for everybody to live their treat. I think one of the big things I saw changing about Paris is the outlying arrondissement. So it was always, the cool place was, the Left Bank. Well, it hasn't been for 30 years probably. But the growth of these new areas further out where there's large North African populations or other immigrant populations, and what a new kind of city it's created, with new kinds of restaurants, new kinds of activities, and
yeah, it's an exciting place, isn't it? Speaking of exciting, in this book, Edmund White happily talks about cruising, doesn't he? Which I'm allowed to talk about now.
I love that segue. I just love that. So you talk about exciting. So yeah, because we had that episode. So I should, in case you weren't there, in case you missed it, go back and listen to our wonderful Pulp Fiction show where I had described Cornel Woolrich walking the docks of New York or Los Angeles, wherever he was, in a borrowed sailor's uniform, looking to pick up men. And I said, Allison, that thing was a drague. In fact, I knew it was drague from reading Edmund White. And I'm going, drague, what's it called in English? And Allison
and
was
I
going,
said, I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. I'm going, come on, Allison, you know, what is it? And then afterwards, you confessed to me that you thought you might have gotten it wrong. You thought it was cruising. That was your first thought. But then you thought, what if I got it wrong? And Karen was going in a completely different direction.
Yes. And I thought, what if it's something like watercolor painting? And I said, cruising. You think, what's wrong with you? Yeah.
So he's got a whole bit about the cruising on the Ile Saint-Louis, doesn't he?
Yeah. Mm. But really interesting. He's very open about, about his life.
So the Ile Saint-Louis, he lived on the Ile Saint-Louis. It was one of my favorite parts of the book, and he talks, because I keep picturing these bushes. He talks about how the bushes on the Ile Saint-Louis, especially in the part that comes down, so this is that island in the middle of the Seine, and the bateaux mouches, which are these slow-going, touristy boats where people sit and look at Paris from the water, go right by it. And he was always saying that they were in the bushes, quickly putting their clothes back on.
That's right. As when the lights...
Yeah. And the lights of the bateaux mouches suddenly flash onto the greenery. I actually had it confirmed to me last night by someone who was in Paris in the same time period, same time frame as Edwin White, that indeed, yes, Ile Saint-Louis was a well-known spot for the wildlife within the bushes, hiding among the bushes.
Gosh, the things you learn.
This is not books. This is what happens, right?
I know.
Books and Beyond.
Yes.
Things you learn.
Yeah.
He has another book, which I'll just put it out there. It's not so much about places in Paris. It's more about his life in Paris and his observations on what kinds of people the French are. A big discussion about the French need to always be right, which I found, maybe that's the intimidating thing.
I think it is.
The French need to always be right. And it's called Inside a Pearl, and it's a memoir. It came out probably about 10 years ago.
About that. Yeah. Oh, he's so good. Now, we're talking about the intimidation, the elegance of Paris as well. One that I love is the elegance of the hedgehog.
Did we talk about the elegance of Paris?
Yes, perhaps we weren't. Perhaps I was just...
You were thinking it in your mind.
Yes.
I'm trying to think. So not Jim Morrison, not Oscar Wilde's Graves Testicles, not... Oh, the piano, possibly.
The piano, or the shopping.
The shopping, yeah.
Maybe, yes. I think of those sort of elegant women that you see in Paris. But this book is just beautiful. By Muriel Barbary, it's a wonderful description of Paris. The main character is a concierge.
Elegance of the Hedgehog.
Yes,
had you said that?
Yes, I did.
Oh,
say
you did.
It. Yes, the elegance.
I guess I was still trying to think of where does the elegance come from.
The concierge is she's a wonderful woman who's trying to hide her intellect. And she's looked down on by the tenants in this upmarket apartment. And she's the one who actually is described as having the elegance of a hedgehog.
Oh, because I always wondered, because I've got the book and I mean to read it. And I have, you know, when I picked it up and brought it home, I did skim parts of it. And she is a really great character and she is kind of prickly. But I was saying, I didn't know where that came from. So she's got the elegance of a hedgehog.
She does.
But, and her one friend in the palace is this kind of precocious girl.
Yes, the precocious young woman.
She's like 12 or 13.
Yeah. And she's the one who describes her as the hedgehog. But they talk quite a bit about the elegant game of rugby in it. And I thought, considering we are in the middle of a bit of a rugby tournament, I think, at the moment, aren't we? Is it the World Cup or something like that? And so there's a beautiful description of the All Blacks versus France. It's written sort of almost in a sensual way, and definitely Jonah Lomu is the great forward, the All Black forward who runs so beautifully and elegantly across the pitch. So it's a great one. I recommend that.
For Paris lovers.
Yes.
It's interesting how just hearing about Jonah Lomu has already brought a nostalgia in me, and yet I think of that book as so contemporary.
Yes.
It's how quickly things going to be nostalgic, you know. It doesn't take very much time at all. I want to give you, just before we go, because I can see time is getting short, but one of my favorite books about Paris, A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway. So this was a book put together in his old age from uncollected writings about Paris, but it's Paris when he was young. And he's got this lovely epigram in the beginning. It says, if you are lucky enough to have lived in Paris as a young man, then wherever you go for the rest of your life, it stays with you, for Paris is a movable feast.
Mm, isn't that beautiful?
And isn't it sort of like, even if you visited, I think we could say, even if you were lucky enough to visit or are lucky enough now to go visit, it will stay with you.
And you take your memories away with you. You carry them as though they're a little feast, a little picnic basket of memories. So that's just been beautiful. Thanks so much for today, Karen. I've loved talking about
it. De rien.
Yeah.
Je vous en prie.
It's been
lovely.
Yeah, it's been really great. And thanks for joining us, listeners, today at our Movable Feast. Happy reading. Until next time, ka kite anō.
Ka kite anō.
And haere rā.
This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond. Every day.